Our topic for tonight is Hungarian ultra-Orthodoxy. Oh boy. So, let me begin by saying, or trying to offer a definition of ultra-Orthodoxy. Ultra-Orthodoxy as a social phenomenon does not exist until the post-World War I era, when the Edah Haredit and the Naturei Karta are formed in Yerushalayim, and or in the United States when the Hungarian Hasidim of Satmar Munkash et al. Established their enclaves in Brooklyn in the late 1940s. But prior to that, ultra-Orthodoxy exists as a concept, as an idea, but not as a distinct social group, separate from other forms of Judaism. But it should become as no surprise to us that it was the Hungarian Jews who at a later time formed these distinct groups, because the idea itself gets off the ground in Hungary, but a good half century earlier in the 1860s. Why the 1860s? So tonight we'll find out some of the historical reasons why that time and that place.
Well, what's the relationship between ultra-Orthodoxy and Hasidism?
Okay. So I would say that the Lithuanian yeshiva world and the Hasidut of Poland and Russia do not represent ultra-Orthodoxy, but rather plain old Orthodoxy, in the sense that ultra is when you take the tradition and you manufacture a more traditional form of the tradition for the sake of fighting non-tradition, as opposed to simply living your existence without regard for the existence of other groups that are peripherally related to your group. So the Hungarian ultras are, as we're going to see tonight, manipulating the tradition to create the myth of a more traditional tradition, whereas the yeshivas of Lithuania and the Hasidic courts of Poland simply continued along the lines that they had inherited, with a little bit of tinkering along the edges. Okay. Chabad is in the pre-war era. Chabad is in no way ultra-Orthodox. It's simply traditional Judaism holding on fast to observance in Soviet or Tsarist Russia.
Okay.
No, not at all. Not at all. Hasidut at that point was almost radical reform. I mean, at least in the eyes of the Vilna Gaon, it was. Okay. So let's examine what happened in Hungary. The Neolog movement, which is a moderate reform movement that spreads to Hungary between the 1820s and 1860s, is theologically unimpressive. The great theologians of the reform movement are in Germany, not in Hungary. What happens in Hungary is the manipulation of the synagogue service, whether the liturgy or the architecture or other aspects of synagogue communal life, in the direction of a more aesthetic Judaism, more decorous Judaism, but with no regard, basically, for the theological underpinnings of those changes. It doesn't happen in Hungary. It only happens in Germany. And it doesn't ever get all that radical, with the exception of one congregation in Budapest that we spoke about a number of weeks ago, that basically Neolog Judaism is of a very moderate form of non-Orthodoxy. And yet, the fire that the Orthodox breathe against the Neolog movement in Hungary is very intense, maybe even more so than other parts of the Jewish world, where the reform was much more extreme. But then again, that's just the nature of Hungarian Jewish life. Everything is more intense and everything is more extreme. So the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, Moshe Sofer, he is the leader of the traditional camp. From his arrival in Pressburg in 1806 until his death in 1839, he is the leading rabbinic figure in Central or even Eastern Europe. And he has very radical things to say, extreme things, about the reformers. That they should be written out of the camp of Judaism, that they are heretics of the highest order. All the invective that could be hurled against the reformers, he did. However, there's a caveat. That is to say, although we believe these things to be true, we can't act on them in the sense of writing a group out of Judaism because the government won't let us. So everything is lahalacha v'lo lama'aseh, as we would say in the literature of the poskim. It's the law, but we don't do it. We cannot eliminate from our communal structure these people who we think are apikorsim. It's just impossible to do.
From what you're saying concerning the government, they're only targeting Hungarian reforms.
Well, we're dealing with the Habsburg Empire in the early 19th century, before Hungary is its own entity, which happens in 1867, and the government does not allow the rabbis, who used to exercise a great deal of police authority, to exercise any more police authority, and certainly cannot oust from the kihilah those who are non-traditional or non-observant. That the kihilah must include all Jews who are identified by the government as Jews, regardless of how irreligious they might be. Okay, so that's the situation in the 18-teens, 1818, when the Hamburg Temple first comes into existence, and the traditionalists are asked to opine about the legitimacy of the Hamburg Temple. Now, Chatam Sofer dies in 1839. After his death, Hungarian Orthodoxy experiences a leadership vacuum. There is nobody to take the reins to be the successor of the Chatam Sofer because his disciples were all very young. They were in their 20s and early 30s. His son was only in his mid-20s because the Chatam Sofer had only daughters early on in life and then had a son very late in the game when he was in his 50s with his second wife. So the Ketav Sofer, Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, is only 24 when his father dies. He inherits his position as the Rav in Pressburg, but still is a young man and cannot wield the kind of authority over European Jewry that his father could. The other disciples, similarly, like the Maharam Shik, were in their early 30s. So there's a vacuum of leadership. And in the 1840s, you have the rabbinical conferences in Germany, 1844, 45, 46... when you would expect the fire and brimstone Orthodox rabbis to issue all sorts of strong pronouncements condemning the reformers. And they do. But, again, these pronouncements are of no consequence because the government doesn't allow you to oust from the community those who you disagree with. So these are all theoretical, but not lema'aseh, not in practice, at least not yet. So they create their own institutions, and communities have a traditional synagogue and a neologue synagogue, but they're under one communal roof, and they don't especially like that. And let's say there's no money for a second shul. Who controls the only shul in town? The people who want to adhere to the ways of the past, or those who would like to tinker with it and have some modern progressive way? Well, the ones who have the most money don't always control the demographics. They don't always have the majority of the population. Then you have a real problem on your hand. The people are against the elite, and what do the rabbis do? Sometimes the rabbis have no say over the matter. It's a chaotic situation.
Ritually, can you give two or three examples?
Yes. So the neologue synagogue would typically have the pulpit and the amud on the bima at the front, facing the audience and not facing the ark. There would be German or Magyar sermon, vernacular sermon. There may be a slight emendation of the liturgy to reflect a non-belief in sacrificial return of the sacrificial cult. There would be a choir. There would be canonicals for the rabbi and special garb for the choir. There would be a choir. Separate seating, upstairs balcony.
Oh,
yes.
And they have an organ.
Some yes, Dohani. And some no. The Dohani, yes, but not all had an organ.
Did they have their own sitter?
So there is no uniform prayer book for the neologue movement, because there is no neologue movement. There are individual synagogues in isolated communities, which will eventually coalesce after 1869 into a national structure that may provide guidance to Kihilot, but they don't give out a sitter. There's no union prayer book. Okay.
What is Austria?
Huh?
Austria is still part of
So the Habsburg Empire is a multinational, polyglot empire that covers a lot of territory, and the Germanic-speaking lands were the core lands of Austria, and also German was spoken by some people in Bohemia and Moravia, the Czech lands, but the Hungarian section of the country included what is today Slovakia, and what is today parts of Romania, because Hungary was big at that time. Post-World War I, Hungary would be tiny by comparison. After 1867, Hungary becomes not its own country, but its own state, where the Habsburg Emperor is no longer the emperor, but he's the king of Hungary. So Austria, he's the emperor, and Hungary, he's the king. It's the same person, but they are now administratively separate states.
Who's the top three Jewish communities within that Europe area that would be?
Okay, so Pressburg is Bratislava, is the capital of Slovakia. Buda and Pest are the two communities that form Budapest, is the capital of the core lands of Hungary. Then you have Debrecen, Maramaros, Satmar. I mean, you have a lot of smaller communities there in the northeast. We'll discuss geography soon enough. Okay. So Galicia is under Habsburg rule, but it's a separate entity. It's not Hungary. And the relationship of Galiciana Jewry to Hungarian Jewry will become clear soon enough when we discuss where people moved, the immigration patterns. Okay. So in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s, you have this vacuum of leadership. Who fills the void? Well, last week I spoke about Israel Hildesheimer. Israel Hildesheimer, who is one of the giants of neo-Orthodoxy in Germany, because he's a German rabbi, German by birth and German in the later years of his career, spends 18 years in Hungary, from 1851 to 1869, as the Rav of Eisenstadt, and where he runs a yeshiva that had secular studies. So, a yeshiva with secular studies is a very progressive and new idea. He is on the left wing of the Orthodox rabbinate. While he was operating in the 1850s, certain centrist Orthodox rabbis could delude themselves into thinking that they were on the same wavelength as Hildesheimer and that secular studies are a necessary evil. Now, what did Hildesheimer really believe? That secular studies were an inherently virtuous thing. Good, you would want to be intelligent and educated in matters other than the Torah. That who wants to be a fool? But the centrist rabbis, generally speaking, regarded secular studies as a necessary evil for Parnassus, or because the government imposed it upon us, and many of those rabbis sent their sons to study in Hildesheimer's yeshiva. So you have this direct personal connection, despite the fact that ideologically they're not on the same wavelength. But that doesn't become clear until the 1860s, when the fault lines are exposed. Let's talk about how the fault lines get exposed. In Hungary, in the mid-1860s, there were 350 rabbis, of whom about 280 were Orthodox. Of the 280 that were Orthodox, about half could be labeled as centrist, whether right of center or left of center or right down the middle. The point is they're centrist. About 25% of those rabbis were left-wing, neo-Orthodox, and another 25% were ultra-Orthodox, hard right. But you wouldn't know who's who unless there are controversies that clearly delineate who is in what camp. Well, how do you create a controversy? Jews don't have trouble creating controversies, trust me. Okay, so the first one is the Kampert Affair of 1863. The Kampert Affair was that Heinrich Gretz, the professor of Jewish history at the Breslau Seminary, the JTS of Breslau, publishes an article in which he claims that the verse in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 52, which traditionally was interpreted as referring to the personal Messiah, the Mashiach Yisrael, actually refers to Klal Yisrael as a whole and not to a personal Messiah. This was interpreted to mean that Heinrich Gretz, what? Does not believe in a personal Messiah. Okay, whether that is a horrible heresy or not, I'm not here to say. But the point is that if you're looking to create daylight, distance between yourself and someone you think is bad, is heretical, is saying things unacceptable to traditional Judaism, you focus on that line of his article and you go to war over it. So Ezriel Hildesheimer was always looking for a way to distance himself from positive historical Judaism of Frankl and Gretz. Why? Because there were people who said, what? That they're really one and the same. That there's no difference between neo-orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. Many people to this day will make that point. Whether they're right or not, I'm not here to say, but they make the point. And so Hildesheimer is sensitive to that criticism. Remember, Hirsch himself had challenged Hildesheimer, what's the difference between your school and Breslau? So he understands, I have to show there's a real divide here. So he issues a call for a petition that all the Orthodox rabbis in Hungary, and for that matter even in Germany, should sign lambasting the publisher Kumpert, a Viennese Jewish publisher, for publishing what amounts to a doctrinally unacceptable article by Heinrich Gretz. And he gets a lot of people to join in this petition. In fact, Hildesheimer was angry with the Orthodox rabbi in Vienna who defended Gretz, that Isaac Noah Mannheimer, who was the neologue or the middle-of-the-road preacher, and Elazar Horowitz, who was the Orthodox rabbi, defended Gretz, that what he said wasn't so bad, it's not apikorsus, it's not so terrible, it's a legitimate interpretation of the verse in Isaiah. And Hildesheimer said, no, this is terribly wrong, we have to expose him for the no-goodnik that he is. Okay, fine. This is the way that the left wing, the neo-Orthodox, are able to prove that they are solidly, firmly in the Orthodox camp and that they are not middle-of-the-road conservative types. Okay. But Hildesheimer's position as a man safely within the Orthodox camp lasted about 6 months, because the very next year, early in 1864, you have a new controversy, the seminary controversy. What is the seminary controversy? So, the Hungarian government, actually the Habsburg government, imposed a penalty on the Jews of Hungary for their participation in the 1848 rebellion. And the money that was collected was intended to go for a seminary, a rabbinical seminary that would be a progressive rabbinical seminary, such that the state could mold Judaism in an image that they liked. So this would not be an independent Jewish school where only the Jews had a say of what's going on, but rather the government would have some behind-the-scenes influence. Well, who wants a seminary and who's opposed to a seminary? Which wings of Judaism like seminaries? The progressives, however you want to define them, whether reform, middle of the road, conservative, positive historical, neologue, give whatever name you want. The forces for progressivism, they like the idea that rabbis will be trained in a modern seminary. Who's opposed to it? So, typically speaking, the Orthodox. Why do the Orthodox oppose a seminary? Well, number one, it transforms the study of Torah from something done by everyone l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven into something that is done exclusively for the pursuit of a professional career in the rabbinate. And that is anathema to the Torah l'shma crowd. Secondly, a seminary, if it really were to be the place from which future rabbis would get their degree, that would adversely impact upon the existing yeshivot. That the existing yeshivot, like Pressburg, is where future rabbis got their Talmudic training, and now they have to go elsewhere, so the classical yeshivot would suffer very serious harm, maybe irreparable harm. So for this and a bunch of other reasons, and just the general opposition to secular studies or the academic study of Judaism, the Orthodox were opposed to a seminary. But Hildesheimer is in favor. The neo-Orthodox are in favor. They like the idea of training congregational rabbis in a modern fashion. Aside from the fact that they like it, They also feel that if the government is going to impose a seminary upon Hungarian Jewry, better we, the Orthodox, should control it than those heretical reform types. Better us than them. So we have to grab the opportunity while it is available to us, while the money and the political power of the state is in support of it.
Who was funding this? The government?
The government.
The government was running the church.
Yes. So that was Hildesheimer's opinion. He was opposed.
Did the government fund yeshivas also?
No.
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 An academic institution.
And I'm not saying even in the long run that when it came into existence that they paid all the bills. I'm just saying that in theory, as it was in the planning stages, it would have been government funded. So.
Didn't they try to do that in Volozhin?
Ah, okay. I'm glad you mentioned Volozhin. So the middle of the row, the centrist Orthodox were led by the following names. The Kitav Sofer, the son of the Chatam Sofer. Rabbi Yirmiyahu Lov, Jeremiah Lov. Rabbi Yehuda Asod, the Maram Shik, Meir Shik, Moshe Shik. And other names who are not as famous. The Kitav Sofer, the son of Chatam Sofer, in opposing the seminary, said, well, maybe what we should do is we should have secular, we should have teachers authorized by the government to come into the higher level yeshivas and teach a few hours a day of secular studies. Now, that might sound like a reasonable compromise if you're trying to avoid the creation of a seminary. But in Volozhin, the school closed rather than impose that standard on them. So they would rather shut the place down than have a few hours of secular instruction because they didn't trust the Tsar at all. And the Romanov dynasty had very sinister intentions when it came to Jewish schools. Different society and different intentions by the government. It was much more benign in the Habsburg Empire than it was in the Tsarist Empire. Okay, so that's what he suggested, but it didn't come to pass. What did the more extreme elements feel was necessary for a rabbi to know, secularly speaking, when going out into the field? So one of the more extreme approaches was it's enough for the rabbi to be able to sign his name in German or Hungarian. Otherwise, he need not know anything other than Talmud and Poskim. That's a fairly extreme opinion. I'd like to believe that most of the rabbis knew a little bit more than that.
Didn't they have to give a Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shul,
right? They did, yeah. But who's to say that you have to cite Shakespeare? All right. So, this controversy is what separated the left-wing Orthodox from the centrists and the right-wing. But then you have the next controversy that separates even the centrists from the right-wing. And that is the Psak Din of Michalovice. Michalovice is a small town in northeastern Hungary. And 25 rabbis got together and signed the following declaration. And we're going to read this declaration point by point because... Huh? Very small town. We're going to read it point by point because this is the most famous Psak Din in denominational Jewish history. Let's put it that way. Point number one. Asur liknos litpaleil bevet hakneset asher ein la bima ba'emtza. It is forbidden to enter into a synagogue that doesn't have a bima in the middle. What is the traditional architecture? The bima, where the amud, where the chazan davens from, or the shulchan, where the Torah is read from, is in the middle of the room, not towards the front of the room. So you can't even walk into a shul that has it other than that setup.
You better move this.
Okay. Secondly, asur la'asot beit hakneset b'migdal. You're not allowed to build a tower-type synagogue. In other words, it can't look externally like a church. In the style of the big spire, okay. Asur lidrosh drasha b'lashon umot ha'olam. It is forbidden to give a sermon in the language of the heathens. V'chein asur lishmo drasha hamura b'lashon umot ha'olam. You're not allowed to listen to a sermon that's given in the language of the heathens. Al kain, therefore, sarich kol bar Yisrael asher yishma asher rav o acher doresh b'lashon nachri la'azov beit hakneset v'latzei l'chutza. So if you hear the rabbi about to get up to the lectern and start speaking in German or in Magyar, what do you have to do? Walk out.
Excuse me, do these people, the congregants, understand?
Okay, we're going to have to talk about that. V'hadoresh tzarich lidrosh b'lashon yahadut. You have to speak Jewish. Shemadabrim bo... Jewish, not Hebrew. Yahadut. Shemidabrim bo Yisrael haksherim anshemidan azot. That the kosher Jews of this province speak. So the kosher Jews of this province, they speak Yahadut, Yiddish. Okay.
So we're gonna
see that that is in the 1860s something that is on the verge of happening, but has not yet fully happened. And so those who want to hold back from any further innovation are clinging desperately to the past, to the very recent past. Okay. Fourth, asur la'asot malbushim yuchadim la'shatz. You can't make gowns or uniforms for the choir, for the chazan, that imitate the other nation, the other religions. Five. Asur la'asot ha'mechitzam avdolot bin ezrat ha'nashim v'anashim b'ofen shiuchlin stakel ha'nashim v'nashim rak yasuk minag me'me kedem v'chenim kvar na'aseh lo yikantzu ba. The mechitza can't be see-through. It can't be that you can peek across the aisle and notice the people of the other gender. It has to be the as it was in the good old days. Me'me kedem. Chadesh yamenu ke'kedem. Where you couldn't see nothing. Okay.
They looked. Point six.
Don't go to a shul that has a choir, even if it means yeshev badad v'yidom, that you don't go to shul at all.
What's seven. The objection about a choir, if it's an all-man, obviously all-man choir.
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that because it sounds like there's no halakhic, there wouldn't be a halakhic objection, and maybe there isn't. That's the secret. Okay. Maybe there really isn't. That's the secret.
It's manufacturing tradition.
Yes, yes. Okay, number seven. Number seven. No. Number seven. Batei knesiot hanikraim kor shul. Those synagogues that are called a kor shul, a choir shul. Me'achar shehu beit apikorsut. Since it's a house of heresy, asur liknos letocham. You're not allowed to go in there. All right. She'afilu adam rodef acharav lehargov v'nachash ratz lakishod nachash lebeit avodah zara. That if a snake is chasing after you and you need to run into a house of idolatry to save yourself, you're allowed to do that, but you can't walk into this shul. Okay, all right. Number eight. Asur la'asot ha'chupa b'beit ha'kneset, rak tia tachat ha'shamayim. The chuppah, the wedding canopy, must be outdoors. It cannot be in the synagogue. Nine. Asur l'shanot shum minhag yahadut or shum nimus bet haknesset masher ki mekubal me'avotenu avot avotenu. Don't change any of the little details of synagogue life as they were received from our ancestors. Okay, so these are 9 points that basically fall into three categories. One is synagogue architecture. Two, synagogues that have adopted the choir, the different style of prayer. And three, the halachic status of those shuls in terms of what a traditional Jew should, how a traditional Jew should relate to them. Meaning, don't go there. It's really bad if you go there. Better you should die than go there. I mean, extreme statements. Okay, so this psak din was signed by 25 rabbis who were there at the conference, and was eventually signed by 71 rabbis overall. And this represents the firm ultra-Orthodox camp.
Not the centrists.
So why did the centrists not sign this document? So aside from the fact that it has some pretty extreme statements in it, they didn't sign it because it was labeled as a psak din, as the law. The Maram Shik, Meir Shik, who was the leader of the centrists, he spoke to some of the far rightists beforehand and discussed with them his attitude towards these points. And he said, if you had labeled it as a migdar milta, an emergency measure made necessary by the chaotic nature of the times, that he could have supported it. But the fact that it is claimed to be based upon concrete halachic sources and the absolute rule, well, it simply isn't. So how could he put his name to this? He won't put his name to it. Even the neo-Orthodox didn't, like Hildesheimer, did not object to all points of this program. Hildesheimer was not such a fan of choirs. He was not necessarily a fan of canonicals or of spire-type synagogues. He could have gone along with a lot of these things. But two of them in particular really bothered him. One was the notion that the vernacular sermon is somehow forbidden. In fact, he gave a vernacular sermon in Germany, in Berlin. And secondly, that it's a house of heresy, or in a more extreme version of this, it was a house of idolatry, those bad rules. He says, now how could it be? They're worshiping God, not Jesus or some other deity. How could you claim it's a house of idolatry? It just isn't. This is a lie. Okay.
And they daven the regular nusach that everybody else daven.
Well, not necessarily, because a bunch of this group are Hasidim, and they would daven nusach Sfard. They were known as the Sfardim.
Who did sign this? Any famous?
Okay, so who signed it?
So when you talk about Hungarians, I'm thinking about people that came to the United States after World War II,
right? Yeah.
And were extreme in Orthodox.
Yes.
So how would you place them? I thought there was Sartre.
Okay, so let's discuss geography now and who the rabbis were. Glad kosher, I know. It was invented in 1956.
Right, when they came from the revolution.
Yeah, 1956.
So
what? Who showed up to this thing? There's a big divide in Hungary between the Unterland and Oberland. The Underland and the Overland. So Unterland is the northeast. The holy rollers of the northeast, Unterland. Oberland is like Pressburg, the northwest. And what happened was that acculturation took place much more rapidly in Oberland than it did in Unterland. In the northwest, which was closer to Austria and closer to Germany, you have Jews who are, in the early 1800s, already speaking German and being influenced by outside trends and losing their piety, such that by the middle of the 1800s, the rabbis in Oberland, who are very, very religious, are devastated by the fact that they are leading communities of people who are going astray and that they can't stem the tide of impiety. And that the rabbis in Unterland, the northeast, are casting aspersions on their colleagues in the northwest for having made compromises. You know, the ones who don't have to worry about making compromises are attacking those who felt it necessary, saying, oh, you're weak, you're not holding firm to the tradition, and you have to do the following, these 9 points. So it was very easy for a rabbi in the northeastern counties of Hungary to say, we're going to tolerate no innovations whatsoever, because their people were not necessarily clamoring for innovations, but for those who were 100 miles further to the west, or 200 miles further west, these were a fait accompli. And sometimes when it's a fait accompli, what do you have to do? Accept it post facto. You know, if we have a choir, we have a choir. If they move the bima to the front, so be it. But it's still going to be a traditional shul in every other respect. So that's the real fight here. The ultra-Orthodox are trying to impose standards on all of Hungarian Jewry that outside of their small corner of Hungary are no longer realistic. Because it's already out of the barn. You know, there's nothing you can do to bring it back. There's never going to be an example of a return to more extreme piety. It's at best going to be a matter of maintaining those who are still very pious. Okay, so
is it that maybe they wanted to put a fence around them to keep the outside forces?
Okay, so the question is, to whom was this directed? The progressives, the Neologue, thought that the Psakten of Michalowicz was intended to suppress Neologue Judaism. In fact, it really wasn't. The ultra-Orthodox, at that point, regarded the Neologues as an entirely lost cause and unrelated to us, they're apikorsim, and we have nothing to do with them. The real target was the other enemy, the Neo-Orthodox, the modern Orthodox. And the goal was to make sure that the centrists don't shift to the left, but rather that the centrists shift to the right.
That the playing out today.
Okay, so the amorphous center is malleable. You can move them this way or that way. The neos are trying to move them to the left. The ultras are trying to move them to the right. The Psakdin, was it effective in the long run? So the answer is that ultra-Orthodox Judaism in Hungary never was able to establish firm institutions at a national level. But they were capable of shifting the center a little bit more to the right and away from the left. As it turned out, The center won the day, ultimately. The amorphous center became the dominant element within Hungarian Orthodoxy, and the far left and far right ended up being insignificant. The neo-Orthodox were almost the non-factor entirely. Hildesheimer moved out of Hungary and moved to Berlin because he realized he could accomplish nothing in a place like Hungary. And the ultra-ultra-Orthodox, yes, they created certain Hasidic communities in the Northeast, but some of them were so distraught and disgruntled that they moved to Israel. They gave up. They gave up hope in the diaspora. Okay, so who are... Huh? Well, I'm going to discuss one person in particular. One person in particular, Schlesinger. So who are the leaders of ultra-Orthodoxy? The three leaders are Hillel Lichtenstein, a disciple of the Chatam Sofer, Chaim Sofer, the Rav of Pressburg in the 1870s and 80s, but not related to the Chatam Sofer, even though the last name Sofer, and the son-in-law of Lichtenstein, Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, the most important person we'll discuss tonight. Schlesinger was born in 1837 and dies in 1922. Okay, and he is the most bizarre character in the history of ultra-Orthodoxy. And that's saying something. Okay, so... But I happen to view him favorably. I don't say that in an entirely negative way. I actually like a lot of his agenda, the part that the ultra-Orthodox would eventually disavow. So he writes a book called Lev HaIvri, The Heart of the Hebrew. And that book is a commentary on the ethical will that Tzava'a of the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer, like many other great rabbis, left behind an ethical will. Not who gets the VCR, but you know what you should do after I'm gone. And in that ethical will, it said a few extreme things, like Besifrei Ramad al tishluchu yad, to the books of Ramad, don't extend your hand. Who's the Ramad? Rabbi Moshe Dessau. Who's Moshe Dessau? Moses Mendelssohn. All right, so Chatam Sofer wrote a few things that were hostile to enlightenment, which we know is consistent with his worldview when he was alive. But what Lev Ivri Schlesinger did was to expound upon that and expand upon that ad infinitum. He was the driving force behind the Psak Din of Michalowicz, all these extreme measures. And what Schlesinger does is to justify extreme positions in Judaism using all means possible. And when I say all means, I mean all literary means possible. When we discuss halacha, how do we determine what the halacha is? In conventional Orthodox psak, how do you figure out what the halacha is?
From Shulchan Aruch and the Rav, the majority of the rabbis.
Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch plays an important role, but what predates the Shulchan Aruch that also plays an important role? The Talmud and the Rishonim. Okay, the whole traditional rabbinic literature from the Talmud on down is examined and analyzed, and you come to some sort of a conclusion. And the Shulchan Aruch's code of the 1560s by Rav Yosef Karo does play a very important role in normalizing or regularizing what the Psak should be. But what doesn't play a role? What other books within the tradition basically don't play a role in the Psak? Well, the Rambam can, but the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, not his other books. What doesn't play a role? The Midrash, the Agarita, the Kabbalah, or at least not usually. There's a whole shelf of books here that we don't look to when we're trying to figure out what the halacha should be. The homiletic literature, the moralistic literature, the sermonic literature, and the mystical literature. For the most part, that doesn't influence how we behave. We behave based upon the halachic codes as determined by the Rishonim as interpreting the Talmud. So what the ultra-Orthodox do is to say, no, everything is fair game. And even the homiletic and moralistic literature, which oftentimes says very extreme and radical things. The halacha doesn't contradict itself. It's not supposed to. When it does, we have a problem. But does the agarita contradict itself every now and then? Sure it does. Which is exactly why we say, Ein sholin al agadot. Don't ask questions on the agarita, because sometimes you have seeming contradictions and we're not supposed to be bothered by it. And you also have very extreme statements bordering upon grotesque statements, like so-and-so is chayav mita, deserving of death, or mitchayav ben avsho if you do X, Y, or Z. Even though those things are not real violations of Jewish law, if they're a violation of the spirit of Judaism, we'll say you're condemned to purgatory or to hell. So let's say you're willing, in determining halachic practice, to rely upon those more extreme pronouncements in the Midrashic literature. What are you going to come up with? A more extreme version of Judaism. Not conventional Judaism of the 18th century before the Enlightenment, and not even the conventional orthodoxy of the first half of the 19th century. You're going to come up with your own form of orthodoxy, which is brand new in the 1860s. That is what Schlesinger does, and what his father-in-law Liechtenstein did, because they feel a need to invent a more potent tradition than the actual tradition, to counter the forces that are working to undermine the tradition. So how many sections of the Shulchan Aruch are there? Four. But in the view of Schlesinger, there are five. You need to have the seichel. You have to know when to superimpose your own view on the Shulchan Aruch, because even the Shulchan Aruch isn't good enough. Okay. So this is his way of dealing with the Psak. The truth...
The young Israel then, and could never have started.
No, God forbid, no. The truth of the matter is that Schlesinger was not the first to play games with the halachic status of certain Judaic practices. To be honest, even the Chatam Sofer in his lifetime said certain things that were an invention of a more potent tradition. His most famous line was Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, that new is forbidden by the Torah. Now, what the plain meaning of that is, in the Talmud, that you're not allowed to eat grain before the Omer is brought on the 16th of Nisan, that you bring the barley offering on the second day of Passover, and that allows the new grain to be considered old grain, Yashan, and now it's permissible, and you can go to the pizza store, it says Kemach Yashan, it's now Kemach Yashan. Okay, but he read it more expansively, that all that is new is forbidden by the Torah. But he also had something else. He said, it's good to elevate a prohibition. Which means, let's say something is forbidden by rabbinic law, or forbidden only by dint of custom. It's a good idea to say that it's biblical law. It's midoraisa instead of midirabbanan. Why? Because then people will listen to it. In other words, on the assumption that people are less inclined to violate biblical law, but are very loosey-goosey and cavalier about midirabbanan, so... Say it's doraisa and they'll listen to you. Now, whether or not that's a strategy that actually works, I don't know. Maybe it did work. So to an uneducated audience, that strategy might very well work. The problem with that strategy is it may be a violation of Baal Tosif, of adding to the Torah. Torah says you can't add or subtract. And the bottom line is we do add. So for the sake of... sometimes, eight lasot l'Hashem eferu toratecha. For the sake of preserving the Torah, we have to negate the Torah. It's a Talmudic concept. But it's a troubling one at that.
That can justify reform, then.
They trust me, they use that very line to justify a lot of their behaviors. Okay, so, what are the ideological innovations of the ultra-Orthodox, of Schlesinger et al.? So one of them is Shalem. And if you read my essays, I wrote about Shalem was about 5-6 weeks ago. For Shalem was for Parshas Vayishlach. I wrote about Shalem. So Vayavo Yaakov Shalem ir Shechem. Okay, Book of Genesis. Yaakov came to Shalem, to the city of Shechem, Shalem, whole. In what respect was he whole? So, in his body, that he was no longer limping on his hip, or that his money was intact, whatever it might be, whatever the perush is on that pasuk. But Shalem was interpreted by the ultra-Orthodox to mean that if you want to be a good Jew, you have to be a complete Jew. Shalem, whole, complete. And what makes you a complete Jew? Not what the Neo-Orthodox say. The Neo-Orthodox say that if you shomer Shabbos, and you go to the mikveh, and you daven thrice daily, that you're a good Jew. No! You're only a half-baked Jew if you do that. You need to be shalem, whole. And what is shalem? Shame, lashon, malbush. Name, language, and dress. Name, language, and dress. So you
your dress is the Middle Ages the medieval...
Whatever the traditional garb of the Jew was in that country before emancipation or before acculturation, that's what you need. So bear in mind, why did all this happen in Hungary in the 1860s? Because of the following. Number one, the government issued compulsory education. Number two, there was linguistic acculturation, first to German and then to Magyar. Three, there was a strong pressure against all ethnic minorities, including Jews, to develop a Magyar national identity. And four, there was a reform movement going on. So these are four factors that lead the ultra-Orthodox to try to consolidate what they have and to invent a potent tradition. So what the business of no vernacular sermon. But what the Jews spoke Magyar, right? Okay? So the answer is that in the Northwest, they probably did speak German, and then later some, whether Hungarian or other, or maybe they kept German. In the Northeast, eventually they spoke Hungarian. But if you could arrest that process halfway through, then the traditionalists would say, do it, because Lashon, language, a specifically Jewish language, is part and parcel of our Jewishness. Okay? And as for the Malbush, don't dress like an assimilated person, dress like an old-fashioned Yid, which means the long beard, pious, the kaftan, the long talus, okay, worn, you know, not just during prayer services but all the time, and you'll look like a distinct Jew. You won't look like everybody else. On what basis do the Schlesinger say you need to have shalem? So the answer is there are two midrashim that they loved. Two midrashim they loved the most. One was that why were Bnei Yisrael redeemed from Egypt?
They didn't change their name, their dress,
and their language. The problem is that there's no midrash that actually says that. There's a midrash that says why were they redeemed from Egypt? Because of A, B, C, or D, but no single recension of the Medrash has language, name, and dress. Some of them have a bris, or they didn't do idolatry, or they didn't adopt the language of the heathens. It has some permutations of them, but no one recension has all three. Okay, the other one is, and this is maybe even more important than why were we redeemed, rather, the Bnei Yaakov, or the Bnei Yisrael, got together in Mitzrayim, when they went down before the persecutions, and they made a solemn oath, a covenant among themselves, that they would not change their language, nor would they teach the language of the Egyptians to their children, and they wouldn't change their names. There's no mention of dress, but don't worry about the dress, but the point is that a covenant was made to create Jewishness or Israelitishness, so that our people willed ourselves into existence as a separate national entity over and above and before the revelation at Sinai. Meaning, what makes you Jewish? Not that you keep the mitzvahs of the Torah. No. The mitzvahs of the Torah you have to keep, yes, because God commanded them. But what makes you Jewish is the ethno-national trappings of Jewishness. And you need them in order for the religion to survive. Because if you try to have the religion, the mitzvot, without the Jewishness, it's a fraud. It's a half-baked thing that won't survive. Now, who do they point to as an example or a proof that mitzvot without Jewishness is doomed to fail? Who do they point to? Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn is the Avi Avos Satuma, in their view. All right, because Moses Mendelssohn had a hooked nose like a Jew, but that was a physiognomy. In terms of his dress and his comportment, he was a Central European, a Western European man of the world. The fact that he stopped at 4:15 in the winter to daven mincha means he kept the mitzvot. But to the in the view of the ultra-Orthodox Hungarian Jews, it actually makes it worse that he kept the mitzvot. They say it would have been better if he was a meshumad like his children, because then we wouldn't have this confusion. The idea is he was ashamed, embarrassed by the external trappings of Jewishness, so he got rid of that. And he tried to survive on divine legislation, that God gave us these rules, and we'll play by those rules. It's not good enough. Yeah, yeah.
If they were so concerned about Jewish purity and not adopting any trappings or anything regarding their local culture, why did they go to the English? Why didn't they go back to Hebrew?
Okay, so that's a good question, and Schlesinger, well, I was going to save this to the last minute, but I'll say it now. Schlesinger got disgruntled, and in 1870 he moved to Yerushalayim, and he became a proto-Zionist. It's odd, but ultra-Orthodoxy created a notion of Jewish nationalism before anyone else did. Maybe, you know, Moses Hess wrote Rome and Jerusalem in 1860, but before there was a Herzl and a Nordau and Leo Pinsker and the others, here was Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, a long-bearded Hungarian rabbi, basically adopting Jewish national consciousness. And when he couldn't find salvation in Transylvania and in Hungary, what did he do? He picked up and went to Yerushalayim, where he wrote utopian works, bordering on like Herzlian utopian works, in which he laid out the vision for a future Jewish state. Now, it wasn't a Jewish Switzerland like Herzl had in mind. It was a theocracy run by the law of the Torah, but in which Hebrew was the language. So you're onto something. That he liked the idea of Hebrew and a modern Jewish state, but one which was a theocracy. Yeah.
You comment that in these 9 points, he didn't talk about Jewish education.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine. So in 1875, after Schlesinger left Europe and was living in Israel, he reissued the Lev Ivri, in which he put a tenth plank, and that was no secular education. Why was it not in the original nine? So the real reason is because it wasn't in the original nine. But he claimed, I think falsely, that the reason why it wasn't included was because they were afraid the government would come down hard on them for violating the statutes. That because Hungarian state law required secular education, if the rabbis were to say it's usher and you can't do it under any circumstance, it's a yaharag valyav, or better, you should die than this, then they'd get in trouble. And nobody wants to get in trouble with the king.
But even having called the writers with the centrists,
yeah,
the kids together in the same yeshiva versus forming their own yeshiva.
Oh, well, you don't have that because it's too parochial. In other words, after 1871, next week we're going to discuss the schism in Hungarian Jewry between the Neologue, the Orthodox, and the status quo. You're lucky if you have one Orthodox institution in town. You're not going to have multiple institutions at each other's throats, except for in a rare example like where the Hasidim are fighting the Misnagdim and they just can't get along and they have to create separate institutions. But generally speaking, you're lucky if you have one Orthodox institution.
I seem to remember reading that, I don't know if it was in Germany or it was in Eastern Europe altogether, that the government had issued decrees to adopt names.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Now I'm wondering if that could have been part of a reaction to maintaining your Jewish name.
So, yes, the last name was part of the equation, although primarily the issue was the first name, that instead of being Ignatz, you're Yitzchak. Okay? That Hungarian Jews adopted Magyar-sounding names very quickly in the second half of the 19th century. And even the religious ones in the era of the Shoah usually had a street name which was not a Jewish name.
Peter.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. Okay, so Schlesinger's opinion was the only thing that is permitted is the study of Torah and the study of Umanut. You're allowed to learn for the sake of a livelihood, provided that is umanut and not a chokhmah. Basically, blue collar but not white collar. So you can't go to college, but you can go to trade school. Torah uparnasa. All right, not Torah umada. Now, let's in the time we have left, discuss the attitude of the ultra-Orthodox toward the world at large. Hungarian ultra-Orthodoxy did not have a hostile attitude towards the Gentile world. I repeat, did not have a hostile attitude. Rather, it had a curious attitude. It was the so-called division of labor. The division of labor is that God had a plan for the world. The Jews learned the Torah, and the Goyim, they do everything else.
They kill the Jews.
No, they don't kill the Jews. No. There's no assumption of anti-Semitism. There's no assumption. the Jews study the Torah, and the Gentiles conquer the world of technology. And what is the attitude of the Jew towards being a consumer of that technology? It's okay. You can't be a producer, but you could be a consumer. Which means that in the realm of religion, old is good, new is bad. In the realm of technology and science, old is outdated and new is good. So the Jews study Torah, which is 3,000 years old, and that's the revelation. That's good stuff. That's impressive stuff. New material in religion is false. But when it comes to Mada, science, and how to create things, technology and the like, whatever is the latest invention, that's a wonderful thing. So use the iPhone. All right, so they're a consumer, but not a producer. Huh?
You can't create the iPhone, but you can use it.
You can use it, right. Correct. Okay.
Put Israel out of business.
Yeah, yeah.
But they have to understand how it works in order to see whether it's cooked. Let's say on Shabbos.
Yeah.
If you don't know how light works,
right,
electricity, how can you make a determination if it's kosher or not?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that.
Yes, you're up.
So...
when electricity first came out,
the original Pesach
wisdom was okay.
Okay, all right, so here's the thing. The ultra-Orthodox position on studying secular wisdom was that the tradition had allowed it for a person who had already filled his belly with Shas and Poskim. But in the view of Schlesinger and Liechtenstein and Sofer, nobody ever filled their belly with Shas and Poskim, so therefore nobody could ever study secular sciences. But for the one Gadol HaDor who knew it all, he could then study the physics of electricity and figure out what the Pesach should be, whether it's permissible or it's forbidden. But just because it's new doesn't make it forbidden. If it was a new thing in religion, it would be forbidden. But a new thing in technology is okay. All right, we have a couple of minutes left. Let's just do a few more points. In the 18-teens and 1840s, it was the attitude of the Orthodox rabbis that the reformers were very, very bad, were heretical, and needed to be ousted from the community, and nothing good can come from them. And that by Talmudic law, really harsh measures should be taken against them, but we can't do it because the government won't let us. By the 1860s, the government is not interfering as much as it used to. And people are able to put into effect that which before was just theoretical. So the ultra-Orthodox take all the most extreme pronouncements of the Chatam Sofer and the other poskim from two generations earlier and say, let's put it into effect. All these people are not really Jewish anymore. Okay.
Sounds like what's going on in Israel now.
Well, maybe. Right. Here's an important point. In the beginning of the denominational divide, the goal of the Orthodox was to coerce the deviants into returning to proper observance, that by coercive tactics, everyone would once again keep the halakha as you're supposed to. Well, they couldn't implement that, but theoretically that's what they would have wanted. Well, now there's a realization among the neo-Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox that it's not going to work out that way. If anything, we're going to become the minority, and if coercive tactics are going to be used, they're going to be used against us, not by us against them. So therefore, what should be the policy? The policy should be freedom of association. I'll go my way, and you'll go your way, and nobody can impose their will on anybody else, because we're afraid that the progressive forces will be in the majority and coerce their sinister plots against us.
So the will would be coerced within the group itself, to keep, for example, people from straying, if they're already part of the ultra-Orthodox.
Well, that might be true internally once the ultra-Orthodox community is a separate entity. But when the kihilah is a united kihilah, but is breaking down, and the demographic breakdown is in favor of the progressives, wise, forward-looking Orthodox people realize that coercive tactics are going to be used against us, and therefore we have to petition for absolute freedom of conscience. So Schlesinger writes, what's the greatest country in the world?
America.
The United States of America. Why? Separation of church and state. He says there are 30 synagogues in New York, and each one does its own thing, and you affiliate the way you choose, and nobody can tell you what to do. So it's very impressive that an ultra-Orthodox fellow, one of their leading ideologues, is a proto-Zionist and loves America. a little weird. Okay, but the one thing he didn't like, the one thing he didn't like was converts to Judaism. He didn't like Gerim. He noted that there is a contradictory message in the Talmud about converts. One school of thought says that they're wonderful, that they have the highest level of Gan Eden. But another school of thought says they're kashuk kasapachas, that they're like a scab on the body, that they're no good. So his point of view was, the converts of today, they're going to Hildesheimer. They're learning how to be Shomer Shabbos. That's not good enough. If you don't want to wear a bekesha and a long beard and pay us down to the floor, you're not a Jew. So don't convert. And in fact, instead of people coming and becoming Jewish, we should lose some of ours to them. That's what he says. In all seriousness, he says, better we should lose some to them and they should bring some to us. Okay.
So he's circling his wagons.
Yeah. It's a very small circle. Okay. All right. Now, the other thing, the last
point.
That's a separate matter. The last point for tonight is the Erev Rav. He regarded the Neo-Orthodox as the Tzedukim. So the Prushim are the Tzedukim, the Prushim are the good guys, the Tzedukim are the bad guys. But he said, you know what, the Neo-Orthodox, it's not just that they're the Tzedukim, they're the Tzevuin. There's a line in the Talmud that don't worry so much about the Sadducees, and don't worry about the Pharisees. Worry about the Tzavuin, the colored ones, the multicolored ones, because they pretend to be Pharisees when they're in fact Sadducees. They misrepresent who they are. So who's misrepresenting their status? The Neo-Orthodox. Because they claim to be among the Frum, but really what are they? They're among the heretics. And they pass themselves off as pietists. So beware of them. And he says they're the Erev Rav. Who are the Erev Rav? So in the days of Moses, they were the non-Israelites who attached themselves to the nation of Israel and left the land of Egypt and traveled around the wilderness. Okay, so what's the concept of Erev Rav? Not that these Neo-Orthodox are the biological descendants of the Erev Rav, but there's a transmigration of souls. How does that help? If they're the transmigration of souls, then these Hildesheimerian Jews are not really my cousin. They're not my blood brother. And so I feel less guilty in laying the boom down on them and saying, you're out of here. You're not part of my group.
Noah Ravis.
Noah Ravis, exactly. So Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, Kol Yisrael Chaverim, is an important concept in medieval Jewish life. In medieval Jewish life, there wasn't schism. Yes, there were the Karaites, but it's the one exception. Basically, whereas the church had 1,000 denominations, Judaism held whole as a Achdus of Klal Yisrael. How does that break down here? How do the fundamentalists kick out to the curb the ones they don't like? They create an idea that these people are not really my people. They're the Erev Rav, transmigration of souls of people from a distant past who are not my brother.
How influential was Schlesinger?
Not. Well, I wouldn't say... no, his ideas are the germ from which the fundamentalism of Satmar, Munkash, Wittgenstein and the like emerge later on. But, okay? But himself personally, he became like a persona non grata because he left to go to Israel, and then he had fights with the Israeli rabbinate. He didn't get along with people, and when he did, the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel, said even though he was a great ideologue, because he advocated for the creation of settlements in the land of Israel, farm settlements, productive farm settlements, he made a grievous mistake. So even his own intellectual heirs, like Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, don't like him. So in hindsight, no one likes him. I like him as a great historical character of interest, but who has an affinity towards him, like religiously, really nobody. Okay, we'll stop here.